Muscle. The podcast is starting.
Hello, and welcome to Podtrificus Totalis, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. I'm your host, Cassie.
And I'm Joe.
And we are here to do Chapter 12 of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, The Patronus, but we are not alone. We have a very special guest today. We have TK Lawrence of the Wizard Rock Group, Totally Nuts. So welcome, TK. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
I'm so excited too. Spoiler, we talked to our guests before we hit the record button. Joe and I are huge fans of Wizard Rock, and you are actually our first person connected to the Wizard Rock world. We've had mostly like other podcasters on at this point. So super excited to, you know, make some inroads here with the Wizard Rock community.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming. Sure.
Of course.
Yeah. We went to a Harry and the Potters concert. I was about to say recently, but there's been this little thing called the pandemic going on. we went to a Harry and the Potters concert in 2019.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was summer. When things were normal. And it was like just a life-changing experience. So
Their live shows are definitely so much different than their recordings.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that was a big thing too, because they played Wizard's Chess, which, like, great song. The live version of it is so good. Like, mm-hmm. So different from the album. So it was just awesome. Like, we left that and we're like, we need to go to some more Wizard Rock concerts.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you're on tour, let us know and we'll
we'll do.
Yeah. So we always start off our guest episodes by getting to know our guests, asking them some questions. And usually the first question is, tell us about yourself and your podcast. But for you, we'll modify it a little bit. Tell us about yourself and your place in the Harry Potter community.
Yeah. So I grew up with the books, and it very much affected my life through, you know, middle school, high school, college, and after. And I got started with Wizard Rock in 2011. I went to LeafyCon for the first time, and they had a trivia panel. And the panel, one of the sections of questions was about Wizard Rock. And I had never heard of that before. So I was like, what now? So after LeakyCon, I went home and I did so much research and I downloaded so much Wizard Rock. And then that kind of kickstarted me from there. So then in 2014, I wrote my first ever Wizard Rock song, Expecto Patronum. Which is relevant.
Yeah, timely for this chapter.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because I was just kind of having like a rough day and I just wanted something to cheer me up. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go for it. And then it happened and I was like, oh, that was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. And it was a lot of fun. So I just kept writing. And now here we are, like 8 albums later or something like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I remember too, when I first learned that Wizard Rock was a thing, I was, me and my sister would go on this website called Daytrotter. I know that that's like ancient now at this point, but they would post like live recordings that they did with indie groups, and Harry and the Potters popped up one day and we were like, Harry Potter and music. Yeah, get me into that.
So cool.
So that was big. And then I introduced it to Joe pretty early on in our relationship.
Yeah.
And Wizard Rock is the coolest. I would say it is maybe the coolest thing about the Harry Potter fandom. I know that like within the Harry Potter fandom, there's been a lot of like activism and charity, but like the Wizard mm-hmm. Rock is really good. And, yeah. And it's kind of intertwined too. You know, like when we went to a Harry and the Potters concert not too long ago and they had like pamphlets and stuff about like, you know, dismantling IC, like mm-hmm, all these other political causes. So I love that Wizard Rock can be like kind of a force for good within a troubled fandom.
Yeah, it totally can.
Yeah. And so on that note, if you're okay speaking about it, you do brand your Wizard Rock as Inclusive Wizard Rock. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I wanted to be inclusive because it's important for me as like a trans person to have, you know, that visibility and all that kind of stuff. And I also wanted it to be inclusive of like, I don't have any swearing in any of my songs, mostly because I'm a teacher is my like real day job. And I'm a music teacher. So if any parent or kid or whatever looks me up, I don't want to be like, you know, rapping and well, okay, I do rap, but it did not, you know, no swear words in my raps, at least. And so so it's like kid friendly, but it's also LGBT inclusive because I am a very strong believer in the ideal of like, we don't really get a lot of positive representation, I guess, in most media, mm-hmm. at least not until recently, you know, with like Steven Universe, and a lot of shows are now coming out with more inclusive characters and storylines and relationships and all that kind of stuff. But back in 2014, I was like, yeah, it's like not really, there's not a whole ton of Wizard Rock that is like trans specifically inclusive. Like there's a lot of queer Wizard Rock with like Draco and Harry, yeah, and Remus and Sirius and Dumbledore being gay. And like, that's awesome. But I was like, is there any like trans Wizard Rock? And I didn't really find anything. So I was like, well, you know what they say, I'll just do it myself. And so that's kind of what happened.
Yeah. And I'm sure that that's become even more important given J.K. Rowling's, just oh, yeah, her in general. I don't think, yeah, we need to get too deep into it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's so important what you're doing. And it's fun that you just said that you're a teacher because Joe and I are both teachers as well.
Oh, nice.
And that is where the decision came to make this podcast family friendly. You know, we try to keep
That's awesome.
Appropriate with the books, not only because, you know, we don't want some parent being like, well, I heard you cursing on your Harry Potter podcast.
Right.
We want it to, because these books are for children and there are certainly adult themes and themes that we will certainly get into, you know, as the books go through. And this is a good chapter to talk about some of that because there's some heavy stuff in this chapter. But I think it's important that children are included in the fandom for something that is a children's series. It's important that they have that space. And I think it's especially important, too, that they have role models within that space and LGBTQ voices within that space. Because I also recently started an LGBTQ club for my students at school. And one of the big conversations that we had in the planning was that question of like, parents are going to be concerned about like, is this appropriate? And there's a way to talk about those things in an appropriate way that doesn't disrespect the students, because this is stuff that they're dealing with and questions that they have. There's a way to do that in a developmentally appropriate way that isn't like crossing any lines. So, totally. So I think that's great that you're doing that. If that sentence made any sense, this is stuff that's been on my brain for a while now.
Yes.
So I, for the record, I teach 7th grade English language arts.
Yeah, and I teach 2nd grade.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm teaching 4th through 6th general music.
Nice. Is that like chorus band too?
It's actually, so we have like separate, so we have 3 separate areas. We have band, orchestra, and then general music, which is mostly like singing, and then music history mostly. So it's fun.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you said you kind of grew up with the Harry Potter books, that they were important for you going through school. But can you tell us a little bit more about that history, about that relationship with them?
Yeah. So I think it started when I was in 2nd grade, I think. And I think it was the time where the 2nd book had just been released and it was picking up popularity. So my dad went out and got the first 2 books, and we always had this like family reading time at night. Where like the whole family, like my brother and I, and then my parents would get into my parents' bed, because it was like a really big bed, and we would just like listen to my dad read out loud the story to us. And that was, you know, like a thing that we did every night. And so we started with the Harry Potter books, and obviously we both loved them. And so I was one of those kids that like grew up with Harry Potter because I was almost his age, you know, like growing up. I mean, I was a little bit younger at that point, but there was, you know, the book releases we dressed up for and went out at midnight, and we went to all the movies, and we just, it was a really big part of like our family deal. And we also, you know, got all of the Jim Dale audiobooks, and I remember falling asleep to those, which probably explains why I have a hard time falling asleep without white noise these days. But yeah, so it was definitely like a big thing that my whole family was like, yeah, we're super hyped about this. And like, we all love it because it's fun for the kids and it's fun for the adults. And like, yeah, super fun. So I definitely grew up with Harry, and I have so many, you know, fun stories about like when the books came out, like the one time that I threw up in the car because I was like, I'm going to read this even though I know I'm car sick. And then I was like, well, never mind. And like the time that the last book came out, we were on vacation. And I was like ignoring my grandparents the entire time because I just wanted to read through it. It was definitely fun growing up with Harry.
That's sweet. Yeah. And it's a similar story, I think, for a lot of people in the millennial age group of like they at least grew up with Harry Potter, or like it was in your case, a family thing that you all bonded together over. I am curious, how long did the family read alouds last? Like, were you all reading like Deathly Hallows out loud in your parents' bed?
We definitely were not at that point, because I would have been in high school at that point, I think. So I think we read probably up to the fourth, possibly the fifth book, but I think probably around four, we just started like getting our own books and reading them, or we would get one book and then we would be like, okay, who's going to read this the fastest first, which was usually me because I would read it in like 2 days or 3 days and then pass it on to my brother. So I definitely remember reading the last two books by myself. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure about the fifth one. It could have been either one.
The fifth one was kind of in a weird point with the timeline that like before that they had come out like every year, and then Order of the Phoenix, yeah. I think it was like 2 or 3 years between that and Goblet of Fire. So it was mm-hmm. like a weird inflection point, I think, for a lot of people of, oh, I'm old enough now to read these on my own and I want to know what's happening. And this one is giant. So So that's interesting. Yeah.
And by that point, you had caught up with Harry in age, hadn't you?
Yeah, just about. I think technically I'm, 9 years younger than he is if he was a real person today or something like that. Because mm-hmm. I think didn't he turn like 40 this year?
He would have he started school in 91. So yeah, 90. So he was born in 80, 79. Oh gosh, I can't do math. There's a reason I'm an English teacher. Every year it gets worse and worse. And I have to like pull out a calculator for simple tasks. But well, that sounds
I'm
about right.
Meant, like the year that he was in when the book came out.
So Order of the Phoenix came out, and I believe
reversing everything back the
05, 06, 10,
11 years.
Yeah, I think he came out in like 05, 06, around there.
Yeah, in 05, I would have been 15.
Oh, yeah. So you were like right there. I was still a bit younger. I would think I was like 10 or 11 when that one came out. But yeah, cool. So if you had to pick a favorite book in the Harry Potter series, what would it be?
Definitely Prisoner of Azkaban, okay. Like hands down.
Yeah, so you're on the right episode.
I sure am. Yes.
So why, if you can talk about it anyway that doesn't spoil it, why Prisoner of Azkaban? Like, what about it is so compelling?
Yeah. Lupin is my favorite character, and I think that had a lot to do with why the book was my favorite. There's also, okay, so no spoilers.
It's hard.
But there's a very important plot point that happens pretty much at the end of the book that I thought was so well done that like I always use it to compare to any other media that tries to do that thing, because like everything matches up perfectly.
And my understanding too is that they throw it all out the window for Cursed Child. So.
They totally do, and it made me so mad.
Yeah,
and so
that's,
mad.
That's going to be a fun thing for us on this podcast, because neither me nor Joe have read Cursed Child or seen Cursed
Good
Child.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you.
It seems like the right call, but it feels like we have to do it. Like, I'm a big fan of the Gilmore Guys podcast, because I'm a big Gilmore Girls fan, and they had this big debate of like, do we do season 7? Because season 7 is so bad. It wasn't the original creators, and they were kind of like, yeah, we got to finish it. And I feel like it's going to be a similar thing for us. Like, we got to finish it. But
well, see, it's taken us this long to get to book 3.
Yeah.
So
I might have to lift the profanity filter when we get to Cursed Child.
Yeah. I mean, Cursed is right in the name. I have a lot of feelings reading that one, and most of them were bad.
Yeah. So if you had to pick a favorite book then in general, and it can be a Harry Potter book if you want, if you had to pick a favorite book in general, what would that be?
I think it would be Misery by Stephen King.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so Stephen King's my favorite author, and I don't know like how much you know about him, but he's written like hundreds of books at this point. Mm-hmm. And this like last year, I officially caught up to all really? Of his, like, I don't have any more Stephen King books to read. And it's a really weird feeling.
Yeah.
And like, so now whenever he comes out with a new book, like my dad is what he's what got me into Stephen King. And so he'll read a book and then immediately ship it to me so that I can read it like right after it comes out. So I'm like, right now, I'm still caught up on all of the Stephen King books. Wow, so, but Misery is probably my favorite book, just because it's written so well and the story is so cool. But also the movie adaptation is like one of the best book to movie adaptations that have ever been made.
So if you were going to recommend someone a Stephen King book to start with, someone who has, say, never read a Stephen King book, seen bits and pieces of movies, what would you tell that person to read, this fictional person?
Does this person like horror stories?
Terrified, gets nightmares all the time.
Okay. I would start with Through the Eyes of the Dragon.
Okay.
Which I believe was called, it was originally called Napkins, but I think now it's called Through the Eyes of the Dragon.
That's a better title.
That was the first story that my dad ever read to me. That was Stephen King. And because it's more, I don't want to say it's more geared towards kids, but he definitely like had his daughter in mind when he wrote it, like his young daughter. So it's definitely the most like, I'd say like safe for work book that he's done.
Safe for
like,
babies.
Safe for babies. Yes. So I would start with that, but Misery is just so good. And then there's, you know, like I would go through the classics, honestly, like Carrie. I would not recommend reading it right away.
Yeah.
Because though it is really good, it's huge.
Yeah.
And it's very heavy. I also really liked The Stand, but that was also 1,600 pages long, so you probably don't want to start with that either.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say, like, he has now that I'm thinking about it, he has a ton of short stories. I highly recommend all of his short stories. So, like, I would start out getting a book, like, and there are tons of books that are just compilations of his short stories. Highly recommend starting with those because those are really awesome.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Spoiler, I'm that hypothetical person.
yeah, I kind of figured.
I'm like at this point in my life, I finished grad school a few months ago. And so I'm like totally done with academia. I don't want to say totally done forever, but like,
yeah,
I'm at a point in my life where I'm like, oh, I have leisure time. Like I can read again.
Yeah.
I need to start reading again. So I've always been like fascinated by horror, but I'm also a baby, so I can't get through any horror stuff. But I read,
Of Wikipedia plot synopsis.
Yes, I've read a lot of Wikipedia plot synopsis because I've like, I start movies or like I see a movie poster. I'm like, that looks interesting. Like I can't watch it, but I have to know what happens. But a few years ago, I was like really into House of Leaves by Mark Z. Danielski. I don't know how to say his last name. If you've ever heard of it, it's like a big horror, weird puzzle book. Kind of, if that makes sense. It's a hard book to describe, but I was like really into that. And like, it was scary, but it was like scary I could handle. And I'm told that Stephen King is like scary I could maybe handle.
Yeah, It definitely depends which stories you're reading by
right.
him. Because there are some books that I would be like, oh yeah, you want to read this one, go for it. But then there are some books, and I'm thinking particularly of one called Gerald's Game. I will probably never reread that book in my life because there's like 40 trigger warnings that I could list to you off the top of my head. And I'm not joking on that number. Like, it was really rough, like, for me. And I love his stories, but it was like, oh,
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. I thought about getting like reading some Cormac McCarthy books when I was like a senior in high school because I watched the movie For the Road and it terrified me. And so I was like, well, maybe if I read the books, but then everybody's like, you're not going to be the same person after you read these books. Like you don't come out of the other end of this feeling the same way.
Yeah.
And I think like Blood Meridian had just come out at that point, which was like, even for a Cormac McCarthy book, this is pretty bad. So good. I appreciate the recommendations. Secretly, my motive in inviting guests on is just to get book recommendations. So thank
you. There
you
go.
That.
And honestly, like reach out to me if you're like, should I read this specific Stephen King book? I will tell you like on a 1 to 10 scale how scary it is.
I'll just send you like my like Goodreads want to read list.
There you go. Perfect.
Yeah.
So at what point in Cassie's journey should she read Misery?
Oh, I would honestly say pretty early on. Like it's definitely a lot less I was like a lot less gory because there's definitely some gore. But it's definitely one of the calmer books. I don't know if that's the right word that I'm looking for, because there's definitely a lot of weird stuff that goes on, but I think just the way that it's written so well, you kind of get over like the weird stuff that's happening in it.
Okay. My only experience with Misery is Punch Up the Jam, a podcast that like dissects music and then like makes different versions of it. And sometimes they're parodies. They mm-hmm. dissected Misery Business. And then as their like Punch Up, they turned it into a plot synopsis for the movie Misery.
Oh, that's
cool. I do
cool.
not remember that. Okay. And for the record, length does not scare me for maybe getting into a foray of Stephen King novels. One of my favorite books is 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami, which is like 1400 pages long, and I cannot recommend to anyone for a lot of reasons, the length being one of them, but you know, I'm there to, I can dig in. I can get
cool.
something.
Yeah. In that case, I would actually recommend The Stand, the unabridged version, because it's a very, like, even though it's so long, I think that the pacing is really good. And I personally got to the end of it and I was like, where's the rest of it? Like, I want to keep reading.
Got to write some wizard rock songs that like continue the story of The Stand.
There we go. Yeah, they just had a newer The Stand show released on like HBO, I think. And season one just ended and I was like, oh, it's so good.
Yeah. So I appreciate that conversation also because I think that often the stereotype of like adult Harry Potter fans is that like they've only ever read these books and no others. Yeah. So I think it's important to show everyone like we can read other things. We just really like Harry Potter.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
So you kind of answered this. You said that your favorite character in the Harry Potter series is Lupin, and that is a lot of your attachment for Prisoner of Azkaban. Is there like a runner up to Lupin, or it's all about him?
I feel like it's kind of all about him. I mean, like, I love McGonagall, but I don't, like, think about her nearly as often as I think about Lupin.
Yeah, she's not, like, a primary character. Not that Lupin is necessarily a primary character, but he's a character that gets a lot of depth and a lot of development over the course of the series, whereas McGonagall is kind of just McGonagall the whole time. And McGonagall's awesome.
Yeah.
But
totally.
Compared to a character like Lupin, it's hard to be like, oh yeah, McGonagall's up there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she's definitely like one of my role models, basically. But yeah, she's awesome.
It's interesting that you say that too, because this is the first time that I've read the Harry Potter books in some time, actually. The last time I read them all the way through is after I graduated high school. And rereading this book, particularly Prisoner of Azkaban, as a teacher has been very interesting. In looking at Lupin and looking at his teaching style and how he talks to the students and how he is very honest with Harry, but also manages to withhold information in a way that I don't mean to say like withhold information in like a bad way, but in a way that protects himself. It definitely lends itself to some of the readings that people do of Lupin's significance as a character as like an allegory to some other things that are hard to talk about.
Yeah,
at this point.
For sure.
Yeah.
And yeah. And I agree, because as a teacher and rereading I used to reread the whole series like every summer. And I have since, like, it's been a few years since I've done that. Yeah. But like rereading it now as a teacher, Snape bothers me so much. I'd be like, because I'm like, if you did that in an American school, you would be fired so fast.
Immediately.
Yeah, he's the person that like someone like Draco with a powerful dad should come up and do something about.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, if only. And then this is a question that we added for this book particularly, and this is actually the perfect chapter for it. If you were in the Harry Potter universe, what do you think your Patronus would be?
100% a cat.
Okay, good answer.
I know that's super basic, but I love cats so much.
Any particular like breed of cat you think?
No. Okay. Like just a regular cat. Like any cat that comes out of my wand, I will happily take.
Yeah, we added this question, like I said, for this book, and it's been a struggle. I've been trying to figure out for myself. I don't know. I'm not an animal person. I'm like afraid of animals. I've been attacked by animals in my life.
Aww. Yeah.
But I am very much an animal person, like all animals, any animal. And so I've been trying to slowly introduce ideas of having pets and things like that. And we've gotten her.
We've worked up to thinking about getting a cat, but unfortunately in our current living situation, we can't. But yeah, cat's a good answer. And like, if that's the animal that I learned to tolerate in my life, like that might be mine too.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And it's funny because Pottermore came out with a Patronus test, which was funny because I took it and I got a cat and I was like, nice. Yeah, that scans. But then I had so many of my friends take it and they were like, I got a horse and I'm terrified of horses. And I was like, what? Oh no. And so it was so funny because this happens so often that my friend Allie and I, we are in a Wizard Rock band together called the Dragon Heartstringers. We co-wrote a song called That's Not My Patronus, That's My Boggart. And it's actually like one of my favorite songs that we've written together because it's so funny.
To be fair, horses are so scary. I saw a horse close up. I mean, at this point, it was like 2 years ago. It feels recently because time has compressed in such a way that it doesn't make sense anymore. But I saw a horse up close for the first time, like since I was like a child. And like horses are big. Horses are very big and they're very scary. So like totally, I get that.
And like if you anger a horse, it will end badly for you.
Oh, yeah. I do not want a horse rushing at me. Horses are scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure on the Pottermore quiz, I got a dolphin as my Patronus. And I was like, okay, I don't know anything about dolphins. Honestly, dolphins scare me a little bit, too. So,
But like, I'm with you there. Name an animal and Cassie's going to say that they scare me a little bit.
All animals scare me. Like, I like elephants a lot, but like elephants are really big. They scare me. I wouldn't want to be near an elephant. Awesome. And then this is a question that I don't remember if I put on the planning doc or not, and if I didn't, I'm sorry. And it is a personal question, so I understand if anybody wants to abstain from this, but I think for this chapter it's a good way for us to kind of segue in to conjure a Patronus. You have to think of a good memory, something that fills you with happiness. So, and I pose this question to all of us: can you think of a Patronus memory, something that you would draw on?
Such a good question.
Now, my head goes straight, like, it doesn't go to Harry learning to get a Patronus, learning to conjure a Patronus, but it goes to, like, an episode of Teen Titans where they, like, body switch, and to use Starfire's powers, they have to, like, think of a happy thought, and her happy thought is just the other person not talking.
I regret asking this question.
No, you don't. So that was
maybe
brilliant.
We keep that in our heads and we return to that at the end of our chapter discussion. We see if we can think of a real Patronus memory and not something from Teen Titans.
I feel like the first thing that came to my head is not necessarily like a specific memory, but something that always makes me happy is when it's summertime and I can go on a drive and like blasting my favorite music with my windows down is like one of my favorite feelings.
I think that works. Yeah, because like I don't think it's so much about it being a specific memory. I think it's about your memory of a feeling.
Yeah, just the feeling of happiness that it brings you. Yeah.
Yeah. So we can maybe revisit that as we talk about the chapter, but I feel ready to segue into our chapter summary, unless you have more children's cartoons to tell us about, Joe.
I mean,
is there a Steven Universe episode where they also body swap? Probably, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, that sounds like a Steven Universe
thing. I think so.
I think there is, actually.
Oh, I don't remember it then.
I feel like maybe not like a whole episode, but I think, I mean, there's definitely some like themes of, am I this other person?
Yeah.
Yes.
Question mark. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so the first thing that we always start off with to begin our chapter discussions is a chapter summary. And we try to do this in 30 seconds or less. Now, TK, I will give you the option. If you would like to try to do the chapter summary, you're welcome to, or I'm happy to sub in.
I will let you take this one.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah, not because I don't think I could do it, but because I have a horrible memory.
This is also like,
so I'm like, yeah,
this is a
I just
long
read
chapter.
This chapter. Yeah, it is. And it's like, because the problem is that I just reread the whole series again very recently. And so I don't trust myself to be like, and then spoiler.
Yeah, no problem. So, Joe, you got a timer?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Harry and Ron are not speaking to Hermione after she narked on them about the Firebolt. The new term starts, and Harry begins his lessons with Lupin to learn how to repel the Dementors using the Patronus charm. Harry has some success with what Lupin says is advanced magic, but he struggles with hearing his dead parents. Lupin confirms that he knew James at Hogwarts as well as Sirius Black. After the Firebolt is returned, Harry and Ron decide to make up with Hermione, but Ron finds blood and cat hair on his sheets and assumes Crookshanks has at last killed Scabbers.
28 seconds.
Ooh, yes.
I like, nice. I'm curious, what made you choose narked and not snitched on the Firebolt?
I didn't want to confuse anyone with the Quidditch references. Okay. And also, I'm not that clever. Yeah, so let's maybe start by talking about the Firebolt, because that's how this chapter opens up. So if you all remember, in the previous chapter, Harry is gifted a Firebolt and Hermione tattles. I don't like that word, but she tells McGonagall and McGonagall confiscates it. And that's kind of what sets up this chapter. Harry and Ron are quite upset about this. And we talked about it in our last episode, but TK, I want to ask you, what's your read on this situation? Do you think Hermione is in the right here?
So I really look at this from both perspectives, because like as a teacher I try to do that for any like argument that's happening with, you know, with two kids or whatever. But it's hard because I totally get how Ron and Harry would be, you know, validated in their anger and frustration, because like this is something super cool and it's like, here you go, haha, just kidding. But on the other hand, I think that Hermione was probably smart to do that, because she had a point where it was like, but what if it's dangerous, what if it's hexed? Like, I would rather be safe than sorry, and like seeing my friend get hurt, basically. So I definitely see both sides of it, but if I had to choose a side, I think I'd probably go with Hermione, just because, you know, it could potentially be something really dark and really dangerous.
I agree. And like, yes, this is a very cool thing. Yes, I'm sure Harry and Ron are very upset that they don't have it anymore. But Harry even now knows that Hermione meant well, and like mostly just, and we get the same thing from Wood a little bit later, and McGonagall, like with Wood telling us what McGonagall told him of just, do you really care more about winning a game than Harry surviving the game?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that McGonagall says that to Wood, but she never says it to Harry. That to me, McGonagall is like a mother maternal figure, but not in a direct way. Like, she's kind of a withholding a mother figure, if that makes any sense. And maybe
she's like she's like a nanny.
Yeah, like she clearly cares a lot about Harry, but she's not gonna let Harry know that.
Yeah, it's like it's her job to keep these kids safe and out of trouble.
Yeah. And Joe, I'm glad you brought up Oliver Wood, because we gotta talk a little bit about Oliver Wood in this chapter. So my ex-boyfriend, Oliver Wood, I've moved on to Cedric Diggory since he's been introduced as a character. But Wood is very frustrating in this chapter. And now that the wool or the wood has been pulled from my eyes, do you like that? Was that clever?
No, because Wood doesn't really You can't just replace it that way.
I can see him for what he is, and he totally disregards the potential danger of the Firebolt. And, like, in fairness, so does Ron. But Wood is 17 at this point. Like, you think he could be the adult in this situation, but...
Wood is so desperate for that win.
Yeah.
Yeah, he really is.
Yeah. It's just, it's sad to me that to see my heroes for what they are.
And also, he already watched Harry fall off of a definitely non-Jinx broom and survive.
Yeah. So he's like, what's another fall?
Yeah, as long as he catches the snitch before he falls.
It's all that matters.
He's a lot in this chapter. But classes do resume. The last chapter was Christmas, so all the students come back and classes start back up again. And I have to say, Hagrid's lesson seems pretty good. They're working with salamanders. They all have to, like, gather stuff to keep the fire going because the salamanders are, like, attracted to fire. And, like, this seems like a good lesson. Like, it seems like Hagrid's learning what to do.
It seems like a normal lesson. It seems like it might be a good thing that those worms died.
What are they called? Oh, my gosh.
Flubber worms.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, it seems like he's moved on to something good. It's almost like he should have had some on-the-job training, like student teaching, for example, which is typically the part of teacher certification programs and not just been thrust into this with
no
experience.
Again, this is a private school.
Yeah, we have this conversation a lot that Hogwarts is a charter school.
Yep, I agree.
And in divination, they are learning palmistry, which is like palm reading. And Trelawney says that Harry has one of the shortest lifelines she's ever seen. And for those who don't know, I know a little bit about this. I'll tell you about it. Your hand has a line in it that is your lifeline. And some people's are longer than others. And people who do palm reading believe that means like your life will be longer. The longer your lifeline is. Joe is trying to show me his hand so I can tell him where his lifeline is.
I'm not showing you my hand. I'm looking at it and just saying there's a lot of lines on there.
There is a lot. There's a specific one that is supposed to be your lifeline, and I wish I could tell you which one it is. I don't know. But I did have a friend in middle school who was very into palm reading for a spell, and I showed her my palm and had her read my palm, and she told me that she could not find my lifeline. So
nice.
I understand how Harry is feeling in this moment.
Was it very sixth sense of just like, yeah, you've been dead the whole time?
Maybe. And I think it's interesting that Harry's is short, and we'll talk about that maybe in four books or so. But
who knows? It might happen this book.
Yeah. You know, you never know. Something could happen. Sirius Black is on the loose and coming after him. So I'm always entertained by the little tidbits that we get about Trelawney and divination class. Moving along, Hermione indicates that she knows what's wrong with Lupin. Harry and Ron are commenting on, like, he looks tired, this kind of thing. And Hermione's like, isn't it obvious? And Harry and Ron are like, no, what? What are you talking about? And Ron suggests that Hermione is only saying this to get them to talk to her again. Do we agree with this? Do we think that Hermione actually knows what's up?
I feel like Ron and Harry should know by now that Hermione is indeed smart enough to have figured it out. And she's also not really the type of person that would say that, like, Hermione would never say something as like, I know this thing without actually knowing it. You know what I mean? So I'm like, really, guys? Like, she clearly is onto something here.
The girl who raises her hand for every single possible question. If she says she knows it, she knows it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I did look in. I have this book called The Ultimate Unofficial Guide to the Mysteries of Harry Potter. I had it as a child and I read it all the time. And it's written by one Galadriel Waters. So Galadriel said in her commentary for this chapter that this is a narrative technique that it tells the reader that Hermione has figured out what's up with Lupin. And so we, as readers, should be able to figure it out, too, given the information that we have so far up to this point. That it's kind of a clue to be like, hey, look back. There was something in here. You can put this puzzle together.
You know, something interesting about the way that I read books, and as a Ravenclaw, I should probably not admit this, but I honestly love reading books and, like, not trying to figure out what's going on because I trust that it's going to tell me later. And one of the things that I've learned about being a Stephen King fan is he does this all the time. where he'll be like, and then a thing, and you're like, what? And then it's like, new chapter, and you're like, wait, what? What thing? But and so I've learned to trust that the book will tell me eventually, and I don't need to like go searching for it. So I've learned to definitely like chill out when it comes to like, oh, Hermione knows, now I gotta figure it out. I'm like, Hermione knows, they're gonna tell us eventually. I'm here for the ride. Like, I'm just going to enjoy my time. And so it gets me into trouble sometimes, especially watching like TV shows where I'll be watching with like my partner or a friend, and they'll be like, and I'll be like, whoa, plot twist. And they're like, you didn't see that coming. I'm like, no.
That's interesting, because I feel like in doing this podcast and also in my work as an English teacher, I'm usually so focused on like, let's pick up the foreshadowing and let's look at all these puzzle pieces and how the mystery comes together. But with you saying that, I think that I have this degree of nostalgia for like just following the story along as it comes. You know, when I read these books originally, I wanted to get through it in a day because I needed to know what happened. And so I wasn't necessarily thinking about all these little pieces. I was trying to be like, okay, and what happens next? And what happens next? And what happens next? And I think that gives the ultimate reveals a little bit more excitement, because you're like, I had no idea. Like, I didn't see this coming. So that's interesting. Yeah.
I try and do that sometimes as well. But Cassie likes to, especially when we watch something that she has seen already, and she just like turns on the couch and stares at me while I watch the thing. She likes to very frequently say, well, what do you think is going to happen next? I'm like, I'm not playing your game right now. I'm just going to watch the show.
It was bad, yeah. Too. My sister and I, this was a couple of years ago at this point, we took the train down into New York City. And on the way back, we watched a Jennifer Lopez movie with Vanessa Hudgens in it. And I don't remember what the movie was called. Jennifer Lopez like runs a Walmart in it. Spoilers for this movie, which I cannot remember the title of. It's revealed like midway through that Vanessa Hudgens is like Jennifer Lopez's daughter that she gave up at one point, you know, like at birth, she gave the daughter up for adoption, and they meet as strangers in their adult lives. And so there's this scene before that is revealed where like they just look at each other in a knowing way. And I was like, oh, okay. And my sister's like, what? I'm like, they'll talk about it in a minute. And my sister's like, how did you figure that out? And I'm like, it's just the way my brain works at this point. Like, I'm always looking for that foreshadowing. Like, I see what they're doing narratively. And as cool as that is to sometimes be able to call plot points, it's also very frustrating. Like, I wish I could turn my brain off and just watch something for the pure enjoyment of it, or read something for the pure enjoyment of it, and just like go along the ride that the author has created.
Yeah, I think that when I'm watching something, like I'm a visual learner, mm-hmm. mostly. So when I'm watching something, I can like, I'd say like 7 times out of 10 call what's going to happen. And it gets to the point where, especially with Disney movies, I'm just like, sure. So bored now, because I'm like, it's so predictable. But with books, it's more of what I was talking about earlier of like, I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm fine with that. Like, if it's like a whodunit, I'm not going to try to guess whodunit, because I'm so bad at guessing those things. But like, yeah. If I'm watching something, it's much easier for me to be like, and then this is going to happen. And then it happens. I'm like, wow, what a surprise.
And especially with books, too, there's a lot of information that you as the reader simply doesn't have. Because like, I thought back to Chamber of Secrets when Hermione figures out that it's a basilisk in the chamber. And she has this moment where she's like, I figured it out. And of course, she gets petrified. So we don't learn that information. But like, there's no way we as a reader could have called that it was a basilisk, because we don't know that basilisks exist in that universe yet. We don't get to see the library book that Hermione looked at until they pull the piece of paper out of her hand. So like, on one hand, in this case, I think you could make an educated guess about what is going on with Lupin. But, and especially if you know anything about like his name, you could definitely figure out what is going on with Lupin. But yeah, I think that as a reader, sometimes you just have to go along with the ride and accept that, you know, sometimes there's just a twist or knowledge that you don't have and you simply cannot call what's going to happen next.
I will say this book especially has a lot of good twists in it.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
totally
true. Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if it really leans on those twists. It's just like, Yeah, we can't really get into them anyway.
Yes. What we can get into, though, I think, is which is the main action of this chapter, which Lupin promised Harry that he was going to teach him how to deal with the Dementors. And Harry is... Lupin kind of put him off until after the holidays, and Harry is now like, I need to know. It's after the holidays, so he should have time. And this game is coming up with Ravenclaw. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're playing Ravenclaw next. And he's like, I can't have a repeat of what happened with Hufflepuff. I need to know how to fight them off. And so Lupin and Harry begin their lessons of how to ward off the Dementors. And I think that's the big thing that we'll talk about for this chapter.
It was interesting for the... for Lupin to be able to find a Bogart in, what was it, 3 days?
Yes, Lupin says that he had to search the castle to find a... We've had debate about how you pronounce this. I say Bogart, Harry says Bogart. Sorry, Joe says Bogart.
I say Bogart for what it's worth.
Okay, cool. Glad to know that you're right.
or also wrong.
So Lupin had to search the castle for one to use for their lessons, because he's like, obviously I'm not going to bring a real Dementor in here. He found this one in Filch's filing cabinet, which Gladriel made something of this. She was like, what was Lupin doing in Filch's filing cabinet? I'm like, maybe Filch said, hey, buddy, I know you're looking for a Bogart. Like, come on down.
Yeah, especially because Filch cannot deal with the Bogart on his own.
Yeah, but we do also know things about Filch's filing cabinet.
That's true. Yeah. That's what I was just thinking.
I mean, that is where they pull the Marauder's map from.
That's right. So maybe Lupin was looking for something.
Maybe.
But yes, so Joe, I want to see how you want to proceed with this. May we invoke Spell of the Week in the middle of our chapter discussion, because I don't know how we're going to do this otherwise.
Sure. I was trying to maybe I'll find some information about like how you would strip down the room and check for jinxes. And there's no information on it other than just like I could repeat the couple things that McGonagall already said.
But so do I have your permission?
Yeah, then? Let's just dive into Expecto Patronum.
Which is our spell of the week, Expecto Patronum. So, Joe, tell me what you've got about Expecto Patronum. And I have lots of stuff, too, if you'd like me to sub in.
I mean, do you want to start us off?
Sure. So I looked up some of the etymology behind Expecto Patronum. This is the spell that Lupin is trying to teach Harry to ward off the Dementors. And as far as the etymology goes, this comes from the Harry Potter lexicon. The word Patronus comes from patron saint, which is a sort of heavenly protector or guardian, which totally fits. And the Harry Potter Wiki also points out that patron, I think I'm saying that right, I don't know, is Latin for father as well. And a father can, of course, be seen as a protector or guardian, but this might have additional significance as we read on.
Yeah.
From there, too, the other part of that, expecto, this comes from the Harry Potter Wiki as well. Expecto is the first person singular form of expectare. Also Latin, could be saying it wrong, which means to await. So the incantation translated is I await a guardian or I await a father. Could go both ways.
How do you feel about the Patronuses being referred to as spirit guardians?
It's interesting because this chapter opens up a sort of philosophical conversation that we have to have about the existence of the soul, the existence of spiritual guardians and spirituality in a way, too. If this is drawing on that idea of a patron saint, that is a religious thing. And to this point, religion hasn't really been a thing within the Harry Potter universe. So I'm curious what you all think, but I think it's an interesting addition to this universe.
Yeah, I mean, for there to be all these magical things, I suppose, for there to be just like a light inside a person that lets them be themselves instead of just a husk.
Yeah, so that's the incantation. I pulled up some things. Rowling said that her Patronus memory would be the birth of any of her three children, or when she found out that Philosopher's Stone would be published. And I think that second one ties back to something you said earlier, TK, about like a memory of a feeling, not necessarily a concrete memory. Maybe she has a concrete memory of like where she was, what she was doing when she got that phone call. But quite often, I think our memories are a little more indistinct than that. You know, we can't pinpoint the exact day, exactly what we were wearing. It's about that feeling that we have.
Yeah, and it is the emotion itself that's actually what is fighting off the Dementor.
Yeah, in my song, Expecto Patronum, I also looked at the wiki. And one of the lines in my song is, I await a guardian. You know, like, that's what it means. It means I await a guardian. And so it seems that the Silver Mist turns into something that knows what you've been through. So yeah, it's just, I always thought of it not really as like a spiritual or religious thing, but more of like you're taking that happiness and you are adding it to magic. And then that is creating this thing that is kind of a shield spell, basically, like a very fancy protego to protect you from a very specific thing, which in this case would be Dementors or depression. But I also wanted to quickly touch on the spirit guardian, because I know a lot of people, you know, they'll say like, oh, my spirit animal is blah, blah, blah. But obviously that's very, yeah, you know, taking from like the Native American community. And so it's definitely, I mean, I like using, like, my Patronus would be a cat instead of taking from Native peoples, because like, mm-hmm, you shouldn't take from,
yeah,
I, you know, you shouldn't, well, do that in the first place. People have taken
enough.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've had a conversation, because while we haven't really gotten to deep dive into this, we've talked about it with our other previous guests when we've asked them their Patronuses. So it's been interesting to talk about the problem with calling it a spirit animal and not actually being able to give any more information about what an actual Patronus is.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that's good commentary. And yeah, I think it can be a detached from any kind of religion or spirituality, if you want it to be. I think you can read this as a kind of like summoning, almost like a guardian angel. That's the reference I have to draw on as somebody who was raised Roman Catholic. I'm sure that there are similar things in other religions as well. And you can do a reading of these books as well that sees that they draw heavily on some Judeo-Christian themes. But also those are themes that tie into just myth in general. And yeah, you can go pretty far with all of that. But yeah, I think that I like your idea of like it's giving not corporeal form, but like some kind of form to your memory using magic.
Yeah. And it feels better to say like you're fighting these off with like your own power. You're pulling this from within yourself versus like summoning this like spiritual being to come help you out. This is like your own emotion, your own ability, your own memory, yeah, helping you out.
Because if you don't use your own emotion for it, it's not going to work. It's a very anime thing, if you think about it. It's like, how dare you kill my friends? And then you go all hype and you're like, now I'm 8 times stronger than I was 2 seconds ago, yes, because emotions. Yeah, exactly.
So I do want to circle around to TK, something you've mentioned and something that we talked about in chapter 5 when the Dementors were first brought up, of the Dementors as an allegory for depression. So now if we're following that line, that the way that you fight off the Dementors is by giving your happy memories some kind of power, how do we feel about that as an allegory for depression? That the way to combat depression is to think of your happy memories.
So as someone with depression and has had depression, you know, before, it almost seems like one of those things where it's like, just choose to be happy and everything, yeah, will be fine. Mm-hmm. And you're like,
just go for a walk.
Really how that works. Yeah. So on one hand, it's like, isn't really how that works. But on the other hand, one of the reasons why Lupin is my favorite character is because on the train in the beginning of the book, after Harry passes out from the Dementor attack, he gives him a piece of chocolate and he's like, eat it. It'll help you feel better. And, you know, Harry puts it off for various reasons. And then once he finally takes a bite of it, he like actually does feel a little bit better. Is he completely cured of the attack? No. Is the one bite of chocolate gonna make sure that he's like, you know, fine at the Quidditch match later? No. But it's just one of those things where it's like, here's a coping mechanism. This is something that can help. It's not gonna solve the problem, but it's going to help you feel a little bit better. And that's better than nothing. And I always appreciated Lupin for teaching me that lesson, because I was like, yeah, you don't have to like solve the whole problem right away. You can just take it one piece of chocolate at a time.
Yeah, it's good that you bring that up, too, because something we talked about is that Lupin gave them the chocolate and said this will help. But he was also like, you should go get checked out by Madame Pomfrey, too. Like, the chocolate is only, you know, temporary to make you feel a bit better. This is still a serious thing that points to it as like an ongoing cure, that the cure for depression is not eating a little bit of chocolate and thinking about happy times. It's something more permanent than that. And as somebody who has also dealt with depression in my life, like, I do often feel that the allegory of the Dementors in depression is kind of surface level. I don't want to discount Rowling's own experiences with depression, but I just, you know, it just, it never really feels like it comes together for me. And this is something that I'm often hesitant about too, that like, yeah, you know, you can try focusing on the good things, but when you are deeply and genuinely depressed, that's not always easy or even possible, because the nature of depression for many people is that nothing really feels happy or good in that moment. And you, even if you can think of happy and good things, you don't feel as though you're deserving of those things or that you're worth those things. And that's hard. And yeah, it just, I like your read of it, but so I have this hesitancy toward it.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, it's a very good way to describe depression to children,
right,
who are reading the books, where it's like, what do the Dementors symbolize? A kid can tell you that. Like, it's very clearly obvious what they symbolize in the books, but kids may not know, like, the word depression,
yeah,
or know really what that means. But then when you get older and you're like, oh, okay, I see what's going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely something that it's like a stepping stone, I guess, on the way to kind of describing, at least to people that either are very young or have little to no experience with depression. You can be like, it's like this, like it's literally like this. And they're like, oh, OK, because that's something that, you know, they can imagine and they've read about or watched in the movies, and they can kind of get a grasp on it a little bit, at least.
Yeah, I think that's something that I sometimes struggle with, is keeping in mind that, like, these are children's books. And so if the depression allegory doesn't work out in a way that satisfies me, a 26-year-old person with the life experiences that I've had, like, you know, I have to accept that they're doing something for the age group that they're targeted at.
And there's also,
totally,
as you add more details to the Dementor, maybe you can poke more holes through it. But there's a difference between, like, this is just depression versus this was inspired by depression.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not meant to be a one-to-one comparison. And I think that there is something to be said that, like, as much as I hate that whole, like, just think of good things and, like, you know, wow, thanks, I'm cured, that sort of thing, I do think that there is something powerful in this idea that the way to fight off depression comes from within, that it starts with you doing something and making some kind of choice, even if that choice in the real world, how that actually plays out, is a lot more complicated than focusing on happy things, and it's different for everyone. I think that there is some kind of power in that, like, you have
for
this,
sure,
inside of yourself, and you need to learn how to dig it out of you. And sometimes a mentor, like somebody like Lupin, is the one who shows you how to look for that inside of yourself.
And also,
yeah,
like,
you need a mentor, not a dementor.
No.
I'm not sorry. I love puns.
And this is also, like, a very difficult spell. Like, it takes a lot of practice. It's a lot of hard work,
yeah,
to be able to successfully fend off a Dementor.
Yeah. And that's something,
yeah,
that Lupin says.
Also, yeah, I was going to say that as well.
Yeah. A lot of fully grown wizards can't do this. And he says that in a non-judgmental way, and in a way to make Harry feel better about, like, the progress that he's made already. That's, if we're reading this allegory and continuing, it's like, yeah, a lot of fully grown people just haven't learned how to deal with depression or haven't found what works for them. And that's sad. And I hope that those people can get the help that they need. But yeah, if we're following that metaphor along, it's good to know that, like, this is a lifelong learning process. My next note is the plural form of Patronus is Patronuses.
Nice.
Yeah. There's been some debate about that, apparently. Rowling has said that the Patronus charm is her favorite in the series.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big surprise there. And Lupin says that the Patronus takes on a unique form for every caster. At this point, Harry is only able to produce kind of like a silvery mist, but the fully formed Patronus will take on some kind of form, like a cat, for example. And
yeah.
Harry imagines his to look like Hagrid with a club. And I kind of wish that is what his actual Patronus looked like.
That would have been amazing. Can you imagine?
That'd be
like,
so
no
good.
Dementors would be like, oh, no, I'm out of here.
I would be scared away by that. Like, forget Dementors. You could just use it on regular right. people.
All right, Draco, here we go.
So, Joe, how did I do with Spell of the Week? What do you have to add to my...
You did well. I don't know if it's appropriate to add on that, like, later on it is used as sending messages.
Sure, yeah. I don't think that's a spoiler.
But pointing right back at what if Hagrid with a club got to send messages for you...
Oh, my gosh.
...is a great thought. Like a
big
silver
Hagrid. In Hagrid's voice and yeah. everything. That'd be so cool. Wait, what if Hagrid's Patronus is just Hagrid?
Yeah, I would be sending messages to my enemies that way.
It's like a weird reverse howler.
Yes. He's scary, but he's also just so fun and lovable.
Well, Harry imagines
that's what the club is for,
right,
to make
the club.
It more menacing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I do like that the happy protection that Harry came up with is Hagrid.
Right.
Yeah, I think that is kind of sweet.
I mean, so listen, I did editorialize there a little bit. He says a Hagrid-sized figure, but I think we're just going to ignore the sized figure part and read it as Hagrid. Because, yeah, I think that, you know, Harry and Hagrid have this really underrated relationship that I think is so very sweet. And I love the idea of Harry's protector and guardian being Hagrid.
Yeah, he's very... very apt.
We've talked about Hagrid too as a maternal figure.
Mm-hmm.
That I will fight this to the death. I think Hagrid is a maternal figure. And
100%. Actually, one of my most recent album that I just came out with, it's a non-binary album.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a song called Hagrid, and the chorus goes, Hagrid is a self-proclaimed mom. Because he is.
Yeah.
He totally is.
Absolutely. Like, he takes care of them in, like, the traditionally motherly ways. He welcomes mm-hmm. them into his warm cottage and serves them, albeit bad cakes, but cakes all the same. Tea. He's just this warm, lovable figure that is... in my eyes, coded feminine and feminine, and that's awesome. I love that.
Yeah.
And so I think that this book in general is very much about Harry's search for parental figures. And mm-hmm. so Hagrid, I think, kind of fills that motherly void that's also filled by, like, people like McGonagall and Mrs. Weasley.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the paternal end of that is a whole other complicated conversation.
Hagrid is much more touchy-feely than McGonagall.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I know you had said that your favorite character is Lupin. Mine is Hagrid, for the record.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, Hagrid's great. Okay, I think we can talk more about this lesson, at least, though, between Harry and Lupin, now that we've got the spell-specific stuff out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So they practice with a Boggart. Harry takes several attempts and manages to produce a little bit of something, but he passes out. And one of the times that he passes out, he hears James's voice for the first time. That we've gotten this, like, trickle of information about what happened that night that Harry's parents were murdered, both from that conversation that he overheard at the Three Broomsticks and also his, like, flashbacks that he gets from being exposed to the Dementors. So Harry hears James for the first time, and James is telling Lily to run away with Harry while he holds off Voldemort. And Harry thinks to himself that it's the first time he's ever heard James's voice, which I found so heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's me doing, like, the yikes emoji.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I feel about that.
It puts a weird spin on him being so determined to try over and over again, because each time he does it, he notices, oh, he's hearing a little bit more and a little bit more. And he really is, to an extent, hoping to just keep failing and learning more and more about the scene, just hearing more of the scene.
Yeah, there's a line after he leaves one of the lessons. Harry felt drained and strangely empty, even though he was full of chocolate. And he's conflicted because he wants to be able to conjure a Patronus and protect himself. But he knows that if he learns how to do that, he will never hear his parents again. It's so sad.
Yeah, it's kind of morbid also.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, he's not intentionally like, I'm going to be this goth kid who just wants to hear my dead parents. It's just like, he, you know, that's the only experience he has with them. Because he was, what, 1.5 when it happened? Not even?
Yeah. So it's like closing a door on that, you know, like, yeah, I'm learning how to protect myself, but I'm also maybe never going to be able to access these memories ever again.
And knowing how obsessed he got with the Mirror of Erised, his first experience seeing them at all, not being able to hear them. And now he's getting a taste of their voice, even in this horrible moment, just like another thing for him to cling on to.
Yeah. And that's the next thing that I wrote, that this reminds me so much of the Mirror of Erised chapter, of this moment where, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think the Mirror of Erised chapter was chapter 11 and this one is chapter 12. I'm sure you can do some numerology stuff with that, but it's this idea that has struck me throughout rereading these books and that I think waned a little bit in Chamber of Secrets, but that's back in full force in this one, of Harry having to like piece together who his parents were. And what they were like, and that being so sad, especially for this kid that had his parents taken away from him at such a young age, that, like, you know, for most people, ultimately, your parents pass when you're older. Most of the time, you know, barring any accidents or sicknesses, you've had a lifetime to get to know them. But Harry hasn't had that. You know, he doesn't have a memory of what they looked like or what they sounded like and what their hug felt like and those things. And so any little piece that he can get, he has to cling on to. And it's so sad.
Yeah. And it's also sad. And I don't think that this is a spoiler, but his parents were both only 21 years old when they died, which as a 31-year-old person, I'm just like, oh no.
Yeah.
Like I have a lot of feelings about that. And it's also another song that I've written that's called 21. And it's literally about like that they were that only that young when they both died.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking.
It's tragic. And like as painful as this is and as messed up as this is going to sound, like I think one of the ways that you learn to accept your parents' mortality is by watching them age. And it sucks to watch your parents age. Like it is really hard, but it, in a way, I don't know, it doesn't make it easier. I've never lost a parent. I'm thankful for that. I am terrified of the day that it happens, but, you know, I feel like it's even harder to have to wrap your head around that of like these two people were frozen in time in that Mirror of Erised as young kids. And I know it doesn't seem like that to an 11-year-old, but like it's almost easier, I would think, to see them like bald and gray and like hunched over and knobbly kneed, because then it's at least like they got to live this life. Whereas these are their last moments that Harry is seeing.
Right. And that's all something he gets. That I have a really big problem with the movie.
Oh, yeah.
In the Mirror of Erised. Yeah. It's like, they're like, oh, they're in like their 40s. Yeah. I'm like, no, no.
And I mean, I think that there's something aspirational about that you can make the argument of like Harry is seeing them as they would be if they had never died.
Yeah.
But that's never explicitly said.
Right. Yeah. And I definitely can also argue that point to myself when I'm arguing about all the horrible things the movies did wrong. But that's a whole other conversation.
But there's something deeply tragic that I think you can't take away about them being 21 years old. And there's something deeply tragic in this, too, that Harry is hearing his father essentially sacrifice himself. That, you know, we've talked all about Lily's sacrifice, but James here is making a sacrifice. He's saying, you two go. He's gonna say, I'm gonna fight him off, but like we don't know too much about James's, whether he's a powerful wizard or not, but he's facing Lord Voldemort. We know how this is gonna play out. We know what's gonna happen here. It's really upsetting.
Yeah. And with the idea of like them being 21 and like that is so young. My kids are 7 and 8. my
your students
second graders
should are 7 and 8.
and when I ask them, how old do you, like, whenever eventually a kid asks me, how old am I ask, you know, how old do you think I am? I get, like, mm-hmm. such a wide range.
Oh, yeah.
Of, oh, you're 47, you're, like, 63, you're, and I'm 24 right now. So they just, like, they don't have that concept of time yet.
It's like they can look at me and be like, that's a full true. Adult. Yeah, I can as a teacher verify that that is 100% true.
Yeah.
No yeah. concept of age.
And so Harry comes out of this and he tells Lupin about what happened, and Lupin is similarly shook by this, appropriately shook by it, and Lupin reveals that he was friends with James at Hogwarts, and this explains also Lupin's reaction when Harry mentioned hearing his mother's voice after he had passed out and fallen at the Quidditch match, that, like, Lupin had a reaction to that that we didn't understand at the time. So if Lupin was friends with James at Hogwarts, we can presume that Lupin knew Lily too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad. It's really sad. Think about, you know, and we don't know at this point what Lupin's relationship with James were, if they were, like, loose acquaintances or, like, really close friends. But, you know, it's so hard to think about. Like, you lost this person that was close with you, potentially your best friend. You've got this kid that looks exactly like them who's hearing their last moments. What do you do? Like, how do you maintain, like, a calm sense of self in that moment? How do you continue to try to guide this child toward shutting off those memories? It's
also, while being professionally a yeah. teacher, mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, that's rough.
It is. And Harry also asks Lupin if he knew Sirius Black. And I want to talk about Lupin's reaction here. Because Harry, of course, is following the train of thought of, like, well, I know Sirius Black was friends with my father. So if Lupin was friends with my father, presumably he knew Sirius Black as well. Lupin says, what gives you that idea, sharply? It sounds to me like he's on the defensive here. Why do you think that might be? Like, what does Lupin think is going on here? Because Lupin obviously doesn't know that Harry overheard this conversation at the Three Broomsticks.
Yeah, it seems like that is a well-guarded secret of their friendship. So I'm not sure if Lupin is trying to hide that as well. You know, it's tough to point at this knowing
yeah.
the results.
Mm-hmm. But also, you know, like, at this point, Sirius Black is a very highly wanted criminal. And, you know, if I was Lupin, or, like, a teacher in general, I would also not want to be, like,
connected with a notorious
killer. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I sure don't know this convict who escaped from prison.
And as far as we know, Lupin is agreeing with Harry's point of view right now of how dare Sirius betray James like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he might be sharp of, like, I don't even want to think about that. That's
okay, you know, yeah.
I'm, like, disowning Sirius right now.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, that's something we'll definitely return to as we read further chapters, but I wanted to see what everyone's read on it was. So Harry leaves that lesson at this point. He does have a second one that we'll talk about, but there's a brief respite, I'll say here, where a couple of interesting details pop up. Ron brings up Hermione's impossible timetable again. This is something that we just keep pointing out every time it happens and saying we can't talk about it at this point. There's really nothing we can say without spoiling anything about this. Mm-hmm. But Hermione is drowning in schoolwork, and they don't understand how she's doing it, because she's talking about a class that she was in while she was in another class with Harry and Ron.
Yeah, Ron is trying to put these pieces together and it is not adding up at all. Harry suggests that
I just got this great mental image of Ron trying to put, like, a square block into a circular hole.
Yeah.
I'm always picturing that meme of the blonde woman with the, like,
she's
numbers.
Not blonde.
Oh, with the like the calculations yeah. popping up.
Oh,
yeah,
oh.
yeah. I love that.
I thought you were talking about the one, I think it's on TikTok, the guy that's, like, putting all the shapes into the holes, and he's like, I know what you might be thinking. This one goes, no, it goes in this hole, and, like, all of the shapes fit in the one hole for the children's toy. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about.
And
I
the
don't
woman
think that's really relevant.
Okay, well, no, you said he's trying to put the shapes into the different holes.
TK just put it in the chat.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Okay, we're thinking of two different memes. Yes.
I was thinking of the same one.
Yeah, I'll make that my Twitter image when I post this episode. the woman trying to do the calculations. But yeah, that's Ron trying to figure out what's going on with Hermione.
Yeah.
So Wood also suggests that Harry buy another broom because he doesn't think that Harry's ever going to get the Firebolt back. Wood suggests that Harry gets a Nimbus 2001, and Harry says he won't buy anything that Malfoy thinks is good.
I think Malfoy probably thinks the Firebolt is good as well.
Yeah.
But also, Wood has no concept of money, apparently, because like the Nimbus 2000 2 years ago was too expensive for Harry to buy for himself.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like a car. You know, my car is a 2017 and it was too expensive for me to buy in 2017. But now, you know, it comes down
to a little
bit.
Fair. Harry does have a lot of money in the bank.
That's true. He's also loaded.
He is loaded, yeah. But he has been doing his best to be money conscious at this point.
Sure.
He's not trying to go broke at 14.
I didn't really like the idea of like only Malfoy thinks that the Nimbus 2001 is good. Like, also, it's just a good broom, Harry. Like, by all respects, it's the second best broom out there right now.
Yeah. As far as we know, yeah.
I mean, I think it's just one of those things that a lot of kids and most people do also, where it's like, this person I don't like likes this TV show. I'm not going to watch that TV show. Like, it has nothing to do with the TV show. It just has that, like, that person likes it. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I don't like it.
Yeah, that's fair. McGonagall is worried that the Firebolt may have a hurling hex, which may be what Quirrell used in book one to knock Harry off the broom. Fun little
I like that
through line.
I would not have even thought of that.
That comes from the Harry Potter lexicon. It did occur to me first, but I did look it up on the Harry Potter lexicon to see if there was anything like concrete about that. But yes, that's fun. I should say also my other idea for what the hurling hex might be is that it makes the person on the broom hurl as in toss their cookies. So that was my other idea.
Nice.
And so then we're back at another lesson between Lupin and Harry. And Lupin gives Harry a butterbeer to, like, celebrate his progress, I guess, which Harry remarks that he's had before because Ron and Hermione brought him some back from Hogsmeade. I put that in air quotes. I did it next to the microphone so you could hear it. And Lupin is suspicious.
Yeah.
Now, if Lupin had brought him to Hogsmeade and got him a beer, a butter beer.
That would be inappropriate.
That would be yeah. inappropriate, but also like he would be more suspicious then of like, oh yeah, Harry, Ron and Hermione were able to bring one back to me, but clearly Lupin has found a way to bring one back. So
sure. I think more this is meant to foreshadow something coming in a future chapter.
Okay.
But what could it be?
Can't tell you. And then this is where Lupin explains the Dementor's kiss. So Harry asks Lupin what's under a Dementor's hood. And at first I was like, Harry, this is a weird thing to ask. But then I was like, you know, if this is something that you're terrified of, your greatest fear in this case, I understand this being something that would eat at you. Like that terror of wondering what it looks like underneath there. So I get Harry asking this.
Yeah. And there's also like an additional fear of just the unknown in general.
Yes. And I think that often your fear of the unknown is worse than whatever it actually is, because, you know, you can come up with all of these wild things in your head about like, it could be this and it could be this and it could be this. And that can make you crazy. I think in this case, what it actually is worse than anything Harry could have come up with.
Yeah, the answer is you die, but also your corpse just like floats around forever.
I wonder what they do to those people.
I think they just are Dementors like, now.
So you said that earlier, Joe. Was there something in the book about that? Because I don't think that that's the case, that somebody who has been...
I don't remember that being a thing.
I don't know if it's they don't specify that the Dementor's kiss is what does that, but they do talk about the Dementors turning people into other Dementors through just exposure to them.
I don't remember that either.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, you do some looking around about that. I'm going to explain what the Dementor's kiss is. So the Dementors clamp their jaws upon the mouth of the victim and suck out his soul. Lupin does not know what's under the Dementor's hood. He's like, there's got to be a mouth of some kind. But the only people who know are the ones who have been kissed by the Dementor. And this is the fate that awaits Sirius Black, that he will become a shell of a person without his soul. And this brings up like that mystical, spiritual, religious thing that, you know, the existence of a soul philosophically is something that not all religions agree with, that not mm-hmm. all philosophers agree with. I would say most modern philosophers do not believe in a soul, and most medical science would not tell you that there is a soul. So it's interesting that one exists in the Harry Potter universe.
See, I have a very interesting theory about this that has nothing to do with one's soul.
Go for
it. Let's see what you think about it. So I have read a lot of H.P. Lovecraft books. Harry Potter Lovecraft, yes. Harry Potter Lovecraft books. And for, you know, those of you that are not aware, Lovecraft's ideals are very much prevalent in today's society, weirdly enough. Like, it's made its way into a lot of horror stories. Stephen King actually takes a lot of the ideas from his books and uses them. But it's basically like the eldritch gods are like the thing. And one of the big ideals from it is that if you look at this thing, like your human brain cannot comprehend it because it's so terrifying and like it doesn't make any logical sense, right? Like it, and so you just lose your mind. Like literally that's what happens. And so in Bloodborne, which is a video game, one of the things that you can gain is insight. So the more insight that you get, the more of these eldritch beings you can see and like understand and make sense of. And you're like, oh, I didn't see that thing before, but now there's this towering giant Cthulhu monster hovering over me. That's nice. So I feel like maybe what's under a Dementor's hood is something so eldritch that the human mind can't comprehend it. So that when it does take off its hood and when it touches your skin, you literally lose your mind because your brain cannot comprehend what's happening.
That's an interesting theory that I think too could track in universe with something that we'll learn about in book 5, that there are things in the universe of Harry Potter that you can't see until mm-hmm. you've gained a certain type of experience. That's the way I'm going to dance around saying what exactly they are. I think we all know what I'm talking about.
That's a good, I like that explanation.
Yeah. So that I think can track absolutely. And I think it's interesting too that Lupin, as far as we know, has never seen a Dementor's kiss happen. That like he says, like, I don't know what's under the hood. The only people I do know are the people that this happens to. So maybe the explanation that like the wizarding public has come up with is like their soul has been taken out because they don't understand what happens to this person. They don't understand how you become just a shell of a person. So their explanation for it, they draw on spirituality and religion of like, yeah, it was their soul, when it could be something else, that we have no definitive proof that there actually is a soul. It's just how we understand like somebody's feelings and emotions and sense of self in an abstract but maybe physical thing, if that makes any kind of sense. Yeah. Joe, are you turning anything up?
I guess not. I don't know where I've
been reading some fan fiction. Maybe.
I don't know where I got that information from. I could have sworn that we talked about it in a previous chapter.
No.
But oh, well, I have seen some things about that. Dementors are created when there is a lot of pain and suffering in the air. They can materialize themselves.
That does sound right.
Isn't that like orcs? Isn't that how orcs are made from Lord of the Rings?
Kind of. I have a relationship with the Lord of the Rings books that is not good. I love the Lord of the Rings movies. I have been trying for my entire life to read those books and they're a nightmare to get through for me. I don't know what it is. I have these walls with them.
Now, is that pain and suffering plus elf or?
Well, like some of the orcs are like breeds of goblin and Uruk-hai, and then some of them like come up from the earth.
I think the ones that I'm talking about, they're like made from mud or something. I don't know. I'm not huge into Lord of the Rings, so I cannot say that with any
certainty.
But
I'll ask my sibling is very into Lord of the Rings. We'll get Den on an episode and Den will explain what orcs are for us.
We'll bring them onto our Harry Potter podcast so that they can explain
Lord of the Rings to
us. Lord of the Rings
to us. Exactly. Yeah. So as I said when I was talking about the Dementor's Kiss as well, it's been announced in the Daily Prophet that Sirius Black will receive the Dementor's Kiss. Once the Dementors find him, they are permitted to kiss him, I guess is the way that sounds.
It's like saying we want him dead or alive, like shoot on the spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Harry says that Black deserves this. Which is no surprise, given what Harry learned in the chapter, The Three Broomsticks, when he overheard everything.
He has wanted essentially this, of like, the Dementors aren't affecting him. He can't just go back to Azkaban and sit around and be fine.
Yeah.
That's not enough.
Lupin asks if anyone deserves this. And I think that this is interesting in a lot of ways, that Lupin is signaling, I think, what his beliefs are. How he feels about this morally, but posing it as a question and getting Harry to think about it too, which is a good teacher technique.
Yes, that is like, I can't say anything political to you, but I certainly will have you think about the right thing.
And I think that Lupin has also dodged the question really well. Not that Harry posed a question exactly, but like, Lupin, as a friend of James, would presumably want something horrible to happen to the person who betrayed James and caused his death. So on some level, Lupin not immediately jumping to, yeah, he definitely deserves this, I think suggests that there's something more going on here.
But also, this is very much a, like, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy.
Absolutely. I think you can read it in two different ways. And I think that's why this works so well and why it's so clever on Lupin's part. Because it can go in the sense of just like Lupin is trying to have a conversation about like socially, politically, morally, are we okay with this? But reading it as Lupin's particular perspective, given his involvement, even a tertiary involvement in all these events and with all these people, it's interesting there too.
Harry gets the firebolt back.
Yes, Harry gets the firebolt back. That's the next thing that happens. I'm sorry, I have a lot of notes for this chapter. So Harry gets the firebolt back, and Ron and Hermione decide to make up. Ron and Harry decide to make up with Hermione after,
and they like just casually say like, "Yeah, let's just
this
be
feels
friends
a
with Hermione again."
Yeah, McGonagall does have a great interaction with Harry here, though. McGonagall returns the firebolt and kind of just says like, you better win. Like, Snape has teased me long enough. I'm ready. Like, use this and
win. I need this win.
Yeah.
Like, McGonagall was annoyed that Harry was asking her every day, but you know she was pestering Flitwick the whole time as well.
Yeah. It's fun. So Ron and Harry go to make up with Hermione in the common room. They find Neville outside of Sir Cadogan's portrait, and Neville has lost his list of the passwords, because if you recall, Sir Cadogan has been changing them on a regular basis, meaning multiple times a day. And Neville somehow persuaded Sir Cadogan to let him write all of them down, including the future ones. And Neville has lost that list.
I do also want to say that when McGonagall hands over the firebolt, sorry to go back a little bit, she says that you've got a very good friend somewhere, which was interesting to think about, of like, because it's not Jinx, it's definitely not Sirius Black that gave it to them. So that mystery is just open again of where did this come from?
Can't really talk about it.
No. I know, but
where did it come from? Nobody knows.
No, we know. We'll never find out. That's the thing. We never learn.
Oh, no. Can you imagine? It's like, okay, Harry just has this firebolt now because of a, what's that literary term?
Plot hole.
Like the god of the machine.
Oh
Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
It's like, now Harry has a firebolt for no reason. All right, god, now we can win some Quidditch matches. Here we go.
It wasn't like Harry trained really hard to be good at Quidditch. It was just he got this awesome broom out of chance. And that's how it happens. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Neville has forgotten the passwords. This will be important later on, which is why I'm harping on it so much. But the current one is, Joe, do you want to try to say this, the current password?
Odds bodkins.
Yes. Which is an idiom, if you can believe it, transposed. Odds bodkins is an archaic interjection meaning God's body. And this comes from thefreedictionary.com. So it basically comes from, well, so the word bodkins is a tool that shoemakers and leather makers use to pierce holes. And the most convincing explanation, according to the Free Dictionary, of how this came to mean God's body is that bodkin sounds like body.
Okay.
Fair,
so
fair.
When a cobbler hits his thumb while resoling a shoe, he was likely to wince and exclaim, odds bodkins, instead of like a phrase that we would use that includes the word God. That takes the Lord's name in vain. It was like a euphemism, kind of. So it tracks well with Sir Cadogan as being like a medieval knight, that he would use like an archaic term like this. It does appear in literature for the first time in Don Quixote in some kind of form. There's a line, let's see, odds bodilikins, you have a strange sort of taste. Which there's some parallels there too with Sir Cadogan and Don Quixote. So it's cool to take a term from that.
Now, looking at Sir Cadogan's mindset of I have to change the password 3 times a day.
For security reasons.
Why would you give out all of them at once?
Yeah, because that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
He was clearly not a Ravenclaw in his time.
No, I do not think so.
I like the idea of him having passwords that like have to contain one number and one capital letter and like yes. an exclamation point and like
you have to say
the son
chef.
Of your or the blood of your firstborn.
Yeah. So they do get into the common room because Harry knows the password and they're about to make up with Ron and Hermione. Ron goes to take the firebolt upstairs while Harry goes and sits and has like a nice conversation with Hermione where he tells her like, you can drop a class, like it's okay. And Hermione, of course, reacts like Hermione, and she's like, "A drop a class, I can't. Arithmetic is the best one." But I
think it's significant that Harry points out arithmetic, and Hermione's like, "No, that's actually my favorite. That's the one I really like." Which really tells you there are some that she does not like and should probably drop.
So I like too that Harry is giving Hermione an out, because I think that sometimes, you know, you can get real deep into something and sometimes you need someone else to tell you, like, it's okay. You don't have to do all of this to yourself. Like, you can drop a class. It's all right.
Yeah, we're not going to judge you. Like, we're not going to see you as a failure. Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why would we do that when you're literally the smartest person we know?
But also, how do you feel about Harry not speaking to Hermione for like 3 weeks and then more than that, because he did like 4 training sessions.
Yeah.
So like 4 or 5 weeks without talking to Hermione. And the first thing he says is, I got the firebolt back. Stop doing that class. Do less work.
I'm curious about this, too, because I have a memory of so many times in the books when like Harry and Hermione aren't talking or Harry and Ron aren't talking. And like this happens throughout the series that they like go through these very natural, I think, for friends, these fights. And I'm curious to reread them as an adult and question if it seems like just like little kid stuff or if it seems like they're being really petty or if it seems like, you know, justified. Kind of. I don't think in this case it's justified. That's a long time to go without talking to somebody. Just
yeah, I was gonna say like 5 weeks without talking to like that. If I get mad at like my friends, I won't talk to them for like a day. Yeah. But then I'm fine. I'm like, wow.
And that's the thing.
That's like longer than a month.
Yeah. And like to see her every day.
Yeah.
And maybe part of why Harry says you don't have to take all those classes is he has noticed she is burying herself in those classes this whole time to like keep herself occupied and seeing that she's kind of drowning in it. But yeah, that's a long time, especially knowing that Harry says in his mind right away, like, yeah, Hermione was doing the right thing.
Yeah.
I'm just not happy about it.
That's where it
kind
of bothers me. And I think it's easy too, because this is just one chapter that this happens in, that like some later fights will like arc over several chapters, that like in one chapter we can kind of brush it off. But when you look at the timeline, like Joe did, like that's a long time to go without talking to someone, especially somebody, again, that you see every day, that you by all intents and purposes, live with. They live in the same space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's tough.
Well, Hermione's not out of the fire yet, though.
Yeah. So Ron goes up to take the firebolt and comes down screaming because he's found blood and cat hair on his sheets. And he thinks that this is finally it. Crookshanks has gone in for the kill.
I have a lot of feelings about this.
Tell us, please.
Okay, so real quick, I want to do a throwback to Chamber of Secrets. Because as a cat owner myself now, like I grew up with cats, but you know, my cat Jack, he's the first cat ever that like was mine alone.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And I like, as you already know, I am obsessed with cats. And I reread the books, and Filch in the second book, when Mrs. Norris is petrified, he says something along the lines of like when he goes to the scene and he sees her and then he sees the kids, he's like, "You killed my cat, I'll kill you."
Yes.
Like a lot of people are going to be like, that's a little bit of overkill. But as an adult and like a cat owner, I'm like, I would 100% will also be like, I will kill you for killing my cat. Like, I'd be so upset.
Putting this into like Muggle context of like, your cat is unconscious, strung up to a wall that's covered in blood, and you see three kids just standing there. Yeah, I'm going to be pretty pissed off.
Yeah. And so I definitely, with Hermione getting Crookshanks, I was all about that. I was like, you go, girl. You get that cat. Like, don't let anyone tell you that he's ugly. Like, all cats are beautiful and gorgeous and perfect. And so when Ron is like, your cat is horrible, I'm like, Ron, I don't like you. Like, I have a big problem with Ron, mostly just because he doesn't like cats, honestly. But, you know, like, anytime he's like, let's kick Mrs. Norris, I'm like, you better not, because if you do, I'm going to come after you. But yeah, so for this scene, it's like, okay, I get that you would be upset about this, but like, Crookshanks is a cat and Scabbers is a rat. Like, what did you expect was going to happen?
Now, do you think that Hermione is a good cat owner?
No.
Because this is a conversation we've had. Like, yes, a cat is going to go after a rat. Like, that is in a cat's nature. But we're also like, yeah, you know, Hermione could keep Crookshanks to one area, you know?
Yeah. See, as an owner of an indoor-only cat, I am very conscious where Jack goes. Like, mm-hmm. if we open, we have a little, like, patio outside that's fenced in. But I will not let him out there without like me supervising him, basically.
Yeah.
So I definitely think that as like for Hermione owning the cat, she has way too much going on to be effectively looking after Crookshanks, you know? And it's like, I get why she would want to adopt him. And I totally am happy that she did, because like, otherwise no one would. Like, my cat has one eye. And no one else would have adopted him because there's something wrong with him. I'm sure you could hear my air quotes there. Yeah. He's the sweetest cat I've ever had. And so it's like, I totally agree with Hermione of like, this cat has the potential to be such a good cat and to be so sweet, even though he looks ugly. Like, who cares? Like, who cares if your cat is ugly? Like, it doesn't matter. So yeah, I appreciate her for rescuing him from that. But at the same time, she's way too busy with her full class schedule to like really be looking after him, which on one hand, it's like, OK, cats can look after themselves. But on the other hand, stuff like this is going to happen. You know, if you don't keep your cat in a specific location, like it's going to go out and cause trouble because that's what cats do.
Yeah.
And there's so many situations where like Hermione has carried her cat into the boys' dorm and just like dropped the cat on an empty bed with, you know, Scabbers out in plain sight. And, you know, there's only so many times you can let your cat attack a person and their belongings over and over again. And like, it's not Crookshanks' fault. I think it might be Hermione's fault to an extent.
I think that's the thing. Mm-hmm. If you're going to rescue, I think Crookshanks is an adult cat.
Yes.
You're going to rescue an adult cat that has like a mean streak, which Hermione knows mm-hmm. from the pet shop owner guy, you have to be sure that you have the time and the knowledge to dedicate to like keeping that cat safe and almost retraining that cat, which Hermione yeah. does not have.
But even like or a big part
even
of,
just with keeping
adult,
it
with a, with adult
I was gonna
cat,
say yeah. just keeping it somewhere right. that it's not going to, you know, affect anyone else.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something me and Joe talked about when we were talking about getting a cat, because we wanted to get a kitten and we were like, we're gonna have to like prepare a room that the kitten can stay in where it can't hurt itself and it can't, you know, rip anything up. Like, it's just something that you have to be ready for if you are going to yeah. take in a pet. You have to make mm-hmm. sure you have the right environment for it and that you spend time training it, which Hermione yeah. has not done.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, like, she's a 13-year-old girl. Like, of course, yeah. this is how a 13-year-old girl is going to treat a cat. The school should not let these students just bring in pets willy-nilly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the main reason Harry hasn't had that same issue between Hedwig and Scabbers is Hedwig gets to live somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
They should have like a cat tree.
We talked about this, a cat cafe in Hogwarts.
Yeah. Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah. And that's
or even like just like I was gonna say, like, just put some, have the teachers put spells, you know, like, you're okay, like, boys aren't allowed in the girls' dormitory. That's a whole nother
conversation.
But like, if you can do that, if you can have those stairs be enchanted, just put a spell on, like, you know, that's like cat specific. Cats are allowed to go here, but not in the kitchens or not in the, you know, like, in other people's bedrooms or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure that that would be an easy magical solution.
Or just have McGonagall transform into yeah. a cat and talk to the other cats.
Talk to Crookshanks. Oh, that would yeah. be such a good idea. It's like, listen, pal, I know what you're up to. Can you? Okay, but like, no spoilers, but could you imagine how many problems that would solve if we had just done that in the first place?
Right. Yeah. I'm so excited to talk more about Crookshanks when we're allowed to talk more about Crookshanks.
Yeah, and about yes. just the entire animal kingdom of this book.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
But that is where the chapter ends, with Ron, like, holding his bloody sheets and screaming, which is kind of a Stephen King-like image for us to end on.
Oh my gosh, it totally is. And now let's go read Pet Cemetery.
Ask your parents first, kids.
Yes.
So usually that means that we would go into Spell of the Week, but we kind of did Spell of the Week. Any loose stray observations, things that you noted that we didn't get to? Nope. Okay. So usually we go to Spell of the Week, but we're not doing Spell of the Week because we already did Spell of the Week. We do not have any emails to discuss, but if you would like to send an email to Podtrificus Totalus, you can send it to owlpost@podtrificustotalus.com with your thoughts and feelings and corrections and predictions and whatever you got to share, send it our way. And TK, tell us where folks can find you on the web and listen to your music.
Oh, yeah. So I am totally Knuts on, like, anything, just like two words but no space, no underscore or anything. That's how I pronounce it. Yeah, that's how I've always pronounced it, but like, it's kind of a play on words of totally Nuts anyway, because that's like a phrase that people say. So it doesn't bother me too much. But I am totally Knuts on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I have a Patreon, and I'm also on Bandcamp. So if you want to listen to my music, Bandcamp is going to be the most recent uploads. And then if you have like any streaming service, like YouTube Music or Spotify or iTunes or any, like, literally anything, you can probably also find me there. But for the most recently up-to-date stuff, it's going to be my Bandcamp.
Awesome. And I will link all of that in the show notes and on Twitter and such, so that you all can follow that and purchase some music. I will be doing that soon.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Red Camp right now.
Yes. So you can definitely check out TK online by searching up, I'm going to say totally nuts. Totally knuts. Okay, I'll say it that way, actually, because that does make sense now that you explain. So search up TK online, check out all of that. You can find us on Twitter at Podtrificus. I don't check Facebook anymore, so sorry if you like Facebook. It automatically posts what we tweet. So follow us on Twitter. And we have our website, podtrificustotalis.com, where you can find detailed show notes and a link to email us and to subscribe to the show. And I will also remind everyone, actually, this episode won't come out in April, so that doesn't matter. But hopefully you left us a review for the Podchaser Meals on Wheels promotion.
Anything yet?
No. Okay. yes. And you can join us for chapter 13,
Gryffindor versus Ravenclaw.